I'd like to call the final meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is now 3:44 on Saturday, May 17th, 2025, here in room 120. Please remember to silence your cell phones. Members present today are Representative McCabe, Representative Vance, Representative Holland, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary today is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juneau LIO is Marne Provost. Our committee aide today is my staff, Stuart Relay. Thank you all so much for helping us out today, especially on a Saturday and especially with the variable time today. We have four items on today's agenda for House State Affairs. We'll start with continuation of House Bill 4 on presidential write-ins from Representative Sadler, then go to House Bill 1, Gold and Silver Specie, from Representative McCabe. After that, we will hear House Bill 82 on a state dinosaur from Representative Stapp, and finally continue our discussion on House Bill 133 on payment of contracts from Representative Himshute. So to start with today, we have House Bill 4 on presidential write-ins. This is our third hearing on the bill. On Thursday, we set an amendment deadline of Friday, May 16th at 5 p.m., which was yesterday. We received no amendments. Is there any further discussion on this bill at this time? Seeing no discussion, I would turn to Vice Chair Story for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House Bill 4, also known as 34-LS0127-A, be moved from the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 4 is moved from committee and will take a brief to sign the paperwork. House State Affairs is back on the record, and the next item on our agenda today is House Bill 1 on Gold and Silver Specie from Representative McCabe. We set this bill aside at our last hearing to continue discussion today. At our hearing on Thursday, we did have a discussion about the definition of person in House Bill 1 and whether that includes a government entity. My office did follow up and received a memo from Legislative Legal that we shared with committee members. Per our reading of that memo, governmental entities are not expressly included nor excluded from the definition of person in this legislation. So in response to that concern, my office drafted a conceptual amendment to address that. And at this time, I'd like to move conceptual amendment 3. House State Affairs is back on the record, so I'm just going to restate that motion. At this time, I move Amendment 3 to House Bill 1, Version A, which would state on page 3, line 8, following person, the insertion of the words "or governmental entity." Great. So I think the explanation for this this amendment was just offered, but I'd be happy to take any additional questions. And I'll go to Representative McCabe first.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. So no questions. I support this amendment. There's a couple places in statute where they specifically define something as a person as, including government entity, and then there's places in statute where they don't define it, and they just rely on the statute itself. So it was kind of ambiguous. I appreciate you putting this forward, and I think it makes the bill stronger, so I'm in support of it. Thanks.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you to the chair. I appreciate the amendment. You know, the discussion we had last time, in terms of my recollection and my input on this, was to acknowledge the input that we had from the municipal leagues about some concern about whether or not this would create any obligation on the part of governmental agencies to have to accept this. And I think we just wanted to clarify that issue. So I appreciate the testimony we had before and this opportunity to provide a little more clarity. Thank you.
Great. Seeing no further objection, amendment number 3 is adopted. And so that brings us back to House Bill 1 as amended before us. Is there any additional discussion on House Bill 1? Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So I'm hopeful that everybody got the information that that we sent from my office. We've run this bill now. This is the fourth year or fifth year, I think, we've run it. So we have a lot of data that maybe didn't make it into some of the packet, and we put it all together, such as the tax implications that Mr. Andreasen was talking about and all that sort of thing. They're fully explained in the letters that we sent you and the data that we sent you. So I have much more if you're interested. So with that, I'm open to any questions, and I appreciate Chair Carrick. I think you had some things that you wanted to maybe talk about.
Yes. Sorry, one minute.
While you're looking for your notes.
Yeah, Representative Vance, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think I'm not sure why I'm not listed as a co-sponsor of this bill. I will be soon, because I have in the previous versions of the bill, because I think this is one of the basic functions of government is to provide a means for people to have a secure form of money, of their assets. And by allowing gold or silver as a legal specie, they can feel more confident that their assets, their money, is going to be in something that is going to retain its value. And there's a lot of uncertainty about the future and how the value of the dollar is diminishing and changing. And, are we going to go to – is the value of money changing quicker than what people feel that they can keep up with? And by having this as an option, I think can provide a sense of security for people. And as Alaska being such a leader in gold itself, and we have many other fine metals, I think it's highly appropriate that we take this step to make it legal tender in the state, because the possibilities are great for us. And love that this is being considered and move forward, and hope that, in this legislature that we're able to pass this bill into law.
Thank you, Representative Vance. I also forgot to mention Representative Himshute joined us about 10 minutes ago, and Representative Moore has also just joined us. I also wanted to just offer some brief comments on House Bill 1. I feel pretty strongly that this legislation has had a couple of amendments that make it even stronger and the intent even more clear. And just wanted to note on the record that some of the concerns that were listed at a previous hearing and testimony, I think, have been either substantively addressed in the current version of the bill and or there are small tweaks that could potentially still be made to make that even more solid, but I'm very confident that the bill that would be passed to its next committee of referral has a lot of merit, and the questions outstanding are mostly related to the valuation around specie, which I think is a really good question for the Finance Committee, should they choose to take the legislation up, to get really deep in the weeds on if they'd like. But one reason that I am personally supportive of House Bill 1 at this point and was not at the beginning of session is because I now understand that the sales of items such as a gallon of milk, should a merchant take that, or another item, will still be required to be charged local sales tax. I think that was a major concern from before. And that's not a part of the legislation. And the other thing that gives me a lot of momentum towards supporting this legislation is that Alaskans are using this right now. And right now they don't have any consumer protections because it's essentially seen as a barter item. And I think there was a pretty good argument made for having sort of a definition of specie as legal tender in order to better provide some of those transaction protections, etc. So I know there's a lot of differing opinions on this legislation. I think that the committee has done a good job asking a lot of those questions and addressing some of the potential concerns that are out there. So I'm grateful to see it move forward at this point. And I see you.
Okay, sorry, I just
And I'm just grateful for the discussion on the legislation. I think I had a couple people in the queue. We'll go to Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I'm sorry I didn't know that you saw me. So anyway, I appreciate the information that you sent over, and I might have missed it. I was trying to look because one of the questions I didn't have answered was that there the invited testimony referred to that there's a premium charged when buying specie, and I wanted to know kind of what the general premium is, typical premium charged.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Story. So there can be right now if you buy it from online from JM Bullion, it's just like buying any coin online. You pay a certain amount, spot plus 25 cents or something like that. I'm not sure what it is. It's been several months since I bought any, but certainly I'm going to take advantage of the fluctuating gold mine or gold price. But there can be a little bit of a premium, and like I mentioned earlier, it's the same as when you're trying to change dollars in a foreign hotel. The foreign hotel takes a little bit of a premium for their cost of managing that money because they obviously have to take the dollar bills and do something with them, and it takes staff and everything else. So, that is covered actually in the bill when it talks about generally close to the melt value or to the value of the gold that's in the bill. And I forget where the language actually is. But that was, I think, in one of the letters that we got from Mr. Diaz. So it might take me a minute to find it, but I'll find it.
Thank you for that.
Yep.
Yeah, now I'll just follow up, too. I think that is a really good question to continue discussing. And, again, I think goes back to one of the outstanding potential concerns around this legislation that I have heard is about the fluctuating price and spot pricing of gold and value of the currency itself. And so I think there's a few questions that could still be answered around that part of the potential new market. Representative Holland.
I just have to chime in here for just a second because I've enjoyed this discussion very much and appreciate the chance we've had to work with the sponsor on that. But when we talk about the fluctuating value, I just want to remind folks that when we go to the gas station, the value of our dollar fluctuates every single day, sometimes multiple times a day. So while I do think this is valuable and do that, I think it's important to recognize that we already live in a system of money that has a fluctuating relationship between the thing we hold that, you know, we say is our money and the thing that we can buy with it. In this case, it's kind of the same thing. It's just kind of on the flip side. The thing we hold as tender fluctuates with regard to what we're buying. And in other cases, we just take for granted that when we go to buy milk or buy gas, that the prices are fluctuating constantly. So same coin, just a different side, I guess, would be the analogy. So thank you.
Vice Chair Story.
Hi, yes, through the chair, and thank you to Rep. Holland for that. I just think it's really important. I love the consumer protection part of the bill, but it's just so important that people understand that there is a premium, and just important. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much, truly, for the discussion on the legislation. And at this time, seeing no further discussion, I would look for a motion, Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move HB 1, also known as 34-LS0001/A, be reported from the House State Affairs Committee as amended and with individual recommendations, attached fiscal notes, and authorizing legal services to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 1 has been reported from the House State Affairs Committee, and we'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and set up. Our next bill will be House Bill 133 on prompt payment of contracts. Brief at ease. House State Affairs is back on the record. The next item on our agenda today is House Bill 133 on prompt payment of contracts from Representative Himshut. We did hear this bill on Thursday, and today we will continue discussion on this bill. I just want to say up front for committee members, my intention with this legislation is to take action on it very early in session next year. So I will ask members prior to our first hearings next session to please go back and refer to these committee hearings we're having these last couple of days of session so that we can pick up right where we left off. But that said, we do have continued discussion on this legislation today, and then we will be setting it aside to continue work on over the interim. I also just want to note we have a few agency staff available today to answer questions. We have quite a list. Dandy Bartolo from Department of Labor, Brandon Smith from Labor and State Affairs Section at the Department of Law, Angela LaFlamme at Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Bonnie Jensen at Department of Fish and Game, Amber LeBlanc at Department of Law, Pam Halloran at the Department of Health, and Eric DeMolin is in the room as well with us. So we have quite a lot of folks available to answer questions. Is there any further discussion on this bill?
Madam Chairman.
Representative Vance.
Just ask for clarification. What version are we working from? I'm looking through all the documents here trying to.
Is it the CS?
D, I think.
We should be looking at version T, which is the version that came out of Community and Regional Affairs.
Great, thank you.
Representative Himshut.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I just wanted for the committee's reference to let folks know we invited department folks here today to get their side of why we're having such a struggle. And so really it was meant to be just a discussion. And I also wanted to go on the record and thank department staff for being available on a Saturday.
Yeah.
So yes. For sure. I also forgot to mention to Hannah Locker from DCCD is also in the room. And I guess I would turn to the bill sponsor. Would you like me to call on these individuals and have them provide some comment?
Yeah, Chair Carrick, I think to just go one by one, and I think Angela LaFlamme represents an organization that had a fiscal note that has now removed the fiscal note, and that had to do with requiring upfront payment, which we took off in the CS some departments are already doing that, and so we didn't want to force those that aren't, because some already are, some don't need to. So anyway, it might just be easiest to go one by one and get a couple minutes of commentary on what the issues are, would be my suggestion, but I'm open to however you want to approach it.
I think that would be probably a great way to approach it. I'll look to comments from committee first. We'll start with Representative Vance and then Holland.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I do have a question for Department of Fish and Game. I think you had them on the line, specific to a section of the bill.
Yes.
That way we can just start with them, I guess.
Yeah, that works. We will start with Bonnie Jensen with the Department of Fish and Game.
Okay. I am looking at page 4 of the bill. Ms. Jensen, my question has to do with the federal fish disaster funding that comes to our fishermen. And I'm wondering if that does not constitute a grant, and if that falls under what is considered cash assistance to an individual, which on the bill would be page 4, line 17. Can you tell me if this legislation impacts those federal fishery disaster dollars that come into the state?
For the record, this is Bonnie Jensen with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Through the chair, Representative Vance, it would affect all pass-through funds that the department receives that goes to entities. Now, I'm not certain if the federal fisheries disasters funds that we receive, if we distribute those directly.
Ms. Jensen, you might have accidentally just muted yourself.
Hello?
There you are. We can hear you again.
Okay.
You might want to start that statement over again, just from the top.
Okay. Again, for the record, Bonnie Jensen with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, through the chair, Representative Vance. This bill would affect payments that go to entities. including refunds. What I don't know, Department payments directly to fishermen from the federal disaster funding. The thing that we receive goes to research and administrative costs. So to that unit. What I believe the fishermen are receiving funds directly from Pacific States, but I would have to get back to you.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. Just so you're aware, I appreciate your testimony, but it was kind of spotty. Because I'm familiar with this issue, my brain can fill in the gaps in what you said. But I would like for you to get back with the committee sometime over the interim if those federal dollars that go directly to our fishermen will be impacted by this legislation, because what the bill says is that the grant does not include cash assistance to an individual. And I would like to know legally and through your department if those federal fishery disaster funds are considered cash assistance to an individual. I'm not sure what the legal definition that falls under, and that's why I asked the question. And I would appreciate a follow-up with that, because I know that I have a lot of fishermen impacted by that who feel that their funds are not being distributed in a timely manner. And there are several of us on this committee who have fishermen who feel very, very strongly about this issue, and anything that we can do to help get that quickly would be much appreciated.
And I'll ask Miss. Oops, sorry. Go ahead, Miss Jensen.
Yes, we will gladly get back to you.
And Miss Jensen, the service connection is a little bit spotty, but if you had any additional comments you wanted to add regarding how prompt payment is affecting Department of Fish and Game, please feel free to offer those. We'll do our best to fill in the blanks.
Sorry, you cut out.
Oh, I think, Ms. Jensen, I think the connection's a little spotty, so feel free to reach out to the committee, and committee members can feel free to reach out to Department of Fish and Game as well. Let's go to Representative Holland now.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to offer, as we begin having some input from the individual divisions or departments, that I had some general questions that apply to all of them. And as we start moving into this interim and anticipate picking this back up again in the next session, it would be really valuable, and I know I'm going to be interested during the interim to learn a little bit more about the assessment of this issue. What's going on? What is it about the workflows, the tools, the training, the staffing that's creating the current situation that might help us understand what the path looks like to being able to eventually get to a point where what this bill is asking for, we understand the implications of what it will take to get there. And right now, I think there's a gap, at least in my mind, with that. And that includes as we move into the budgeting period. I'm anticipating that there'll be a budget that's going to come out in December, I believe, that we'll then start looking at. And I would hope that budget might acknowledge that this is an issue and a concern. And while the legislation may not have passed yet, it would be nice to see in the work plans that are being developed, the budgets and the proposals that might come through the various budget subcommittees, that we might acknowledge that this ability to have the staffing, the tools, and the work processes for being able to manage payment of grants might be a topic that would come up again for us to see in that, and some work's been done. I'm also generally curious, as the departments and divisions are looking at this, you know, is this something that every single individual department and division has to resolve this problem? Or are there some more systematic core issues about the software and the tools that we're using for workflow and grant administration that could help us see the path towards a more efficient solution that could be deployed across multiple agencies? I'm aware of some workflow productivity and process improvement steps that, I'm sorry, I can't remember whether it was through Department of Administration or Department of Revenue, but I was impressed that there was some work going on to think more strategically about about how to improve the processes and the tools to think through that and to have the measurements. So I guess that's kind of a general statement for all the departments and division. I'm kind of curious, what are they doing to assess this problem? What plans will they be developing? What could be done in this interim so that as we come into the next session, we understand how the intent of this bill might be carried out more fully, or if there are costs and challenges, we might understand that also more completely. So thank you for the time to share that.
Yes, Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, I guess what would really help me is to have some baseline data when we came back, and there might be some information now. But and it has to do with kind of our budget that comes back in December. But how much penalties and interest are we paying now to our private contractors for not paying within the 30 days, and then we heard there was 10.5% interest charged, and it would be really nice to know what the extent of the problem is, and then when we finally do get most of the payments out. So I don't know how much information we have right now on that, but I think that's really helpful to us to know the extent of the problem before we expand it to other groups, our nonprofits and Alaskan entities, tribal entities, and we want to be prepared to have it be a smooth process.
And I'll go to Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. If I could invite Ms. Lubin up to mm-hmm. talk about, she's the one who's been digging in trying to find out. So, for example, she might know how long our email and reminders have been pending with DOT to try to get some information about delayed payments, and we haven't had a lot of responsiveness there, and we love our liaison there, but if she could go on record and talk about our exploration of exactly the question of how much are we paying now to the private sector.
I think that would be helpful, and as time allows, I'll just say we'll go back to individual departments, but I think just allowing open discussion, just want to remind folks that we do have a lot of department folks available if questions are related to specific departments. And Ms. Lubin, if you'd like to give us a little bit more background on some of the questions.
For the record, Ella Lubin, staff to Representative Himshut, and through the chair to Representative Story. Unfortunately, I don't have solid information to relay to you. When we first introduced this, actually before we officially introduced this bill, we had reached out to the Department of Transportation, who deals primarily with private contractors for public works projects, which are protected through Alaska's current prompt payment statute, 36.30.200. I might have that wrong, but I think it's listed in the bill as well. And we have not heard much information, but we have not heard much information from private contractors either. There's been a few anecdotal stories about late payments. However, it's been difficult to compare our intended stakeholders, so nonprofits, tribes, and municipalities, to these private contractors because cash reserves look very different. So when a late payment to a private contractor comes through in 90 days, it is an extremely different process and different implications and detriments, if any, than when a late grant payment comes through to a small cash reserve nonprofit. If that answers any question, I know that wasn't a lot of helpful information.
Add to that.
Yeah, Representative Himshut.
Thank you, through the chair. I'll just add for perspective, a lot of the private contractors hesitate a little bit to answer the question because they don't want to get in trouble with the state. They don't want to, So it's been, we've also worked through AGC, Alaska General Contractors, to try to get more information. And that's an ongoing process. But again, a lot of folks are willing to just quietly mention, yeah, we had to wait 90 days instead of getting it in 30. But they don't really want to talk much more than that. Mm-hmm. They just don't want to upset the state.
Representative Vance?
Yes, thank you. This is a question for the bill sponsor and staff. Have you looked at when a lot of our money comes through the federal grants, right, the pass-through, and then obviously state funding as well. Have you looked at where the clog is in the process? Have you had any information through the departments about their delays? And by contrast, the example that I'm thinking of is the Fishes Act in Congress. With the fishery federal disaster funding, they found out that money touched the federal OMB at least 15 times. And that's where the clog was in getting the funding distributed to our fishermen, who were my fishermen in the Cook Inlet, been waiting like 6 and 8 years. 8 years, actually. It was before I got elected that the disaster was declared, and they still don't have that money. And they were mad at, you know, it's like they've been mad at the state, but then when you traced every department and touch that dollar had to make once Congress approved, the Federal Office of Management and Budget was one of the big areas. So the Fishes Act was cutting down that timeline significantly because they were able to identify that it was going through so much bureaucracy. So have you, through your research, found out where some of the delays are within the state so that we can help make some of those changes, whether it's through statute or regulation, that can cut out some of the times that has to get approved or touched by departments?
For the record, Ella Lubin, through the chair, Representative Vance, I believe that the Department of Health, who I think is online for questions, would be very well equipped to answer this as they deal with Medicaid reimbursements. And they have a lot of experience with the steps with which federal money goes through to the state and passes through to nonprofits.
Let's go ahead and ask that question of Pam Halloran, who's with the Department of Assistant Commissioner in the Department of Health.
For the record, this is Pam Halloran, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health. Through the Chair, Representative Vance, Medicaid payments, in the most part, pretty much run very, they're strict, very streamlined. The authorization is almost automatic. There's times when they're not, when there's vendors that use subcontractors that flow through the Medicaid system that doesn't talk well with the Medicaid system. And so sometimes there's problems on that side when providers are using contractors, sort of middle people that that runs into problems. And then those transactions have to be manually handled. And so sometimes they'll impact them there, but in the most part, Medicaid payments are fairly streamlined.
Follow up.
So I'm looking at the fiscal notes that came from the Department of Health, and there's six fiscal notes from the Department of Health because y'all do so many things. But each one of them is requesting an additional staff to be able to help with this, which is understandable to a degree. But these obligations have always existed for the department. And I'm just wondering, is there any, besides needing manpower, is there any other statute or regulation that we should be looking at that is requiring more oversight and contact that maybe can be done more efficiently than just adding another staffer?
Ms. Halloran?
Yes, Representative Vance to the Chair. This is Pam Halloran again for the record. When we evaluated our fiscal notes, we looked primarily at, you know, from invoice date to transaction date. So we didn't necessarily look at Medicaid in evaluating our fiscal notes. We looked primarily at from invoice date to payment date. I can tell you that the volume of work in regard to payments within the department is quite large, and we've suffered since COVID from an overall capacity issue in regard to within our division, in regard to staff who review invoices and approve invoices and process payments. COVID, Department of Health during COVID was the primary procurement agent for the entire department with the same existing staff that we had before COVID. It burned people out, people left. And so now what we're doing is we're bringing up a new batch of staff and getting them trained and having them work through that capacity. We do have a significant volume within the department. We have 448 grants, 295 contracts, and those contracts comprise, exclusive of Medicaid, comprise of $575 million for grants and $145 million for contracts, excuse me, and $145 million for grants. But I have to say, compared to 2 years ago, we're in a much better place. We've got new leadership within our grants and contract section, and we've brought on some very strong administrative staff and accountants. So we are seeing improved retention rates, and we do believe that with training and some workflow processes, we can, to address Representative Holler's question as well, we are considering a number of things. One is we're currently examining how we can better leverage our accounting system to have workflow processes in the system and get out of paper and use technology that exists within the department. We are also looking at procuring with a few other departments a grant a new grant system. We think that would greatly benefit our grantees who currently use a different system with each agency. So that's difficult for our partners to learn the process for each agency. So we're working with some partners that share grantees to have a similar system. We also recently brought online a system called Periscope that provides for the onset visibility for contracts for our department. So we're on the other end of it. I hope that answers your question, Representative Vance. I'm happy to follow up.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up, and then we do have a good cue, so I think we'll move on.
Yes, thank you for that answer. I think that's definitely what we're hoping to see here. So I see that because the Department of Health does so much, that you're the largest person with largest department with delays. Do you have if within the grants department, do you have a goal that you would like to see within the next 6 months or a year of decreasing the turnaround time for distribution?
Absolutely, Representative Vance, through the chair, Pam Howard, for the record. We do have a goal within our grants team. Currently, we don't see grants as much of a problem for our department as other divisions. Our department, most of our grants are advanced. So our grants are advanced quarterly to our grantees, with the exception of capital grants, which are on a reimbursement. So and it's currently taking us 11 days from the initial grant agreement to process of payment. But as far as goals, we're working on communication and training with our program manager, because not only do we have grants administrators, administrative staff that execute grants, but we have program managers which work within our divisions who work closely with the grantees and work on the technical aspects of building those budgets and the grant and the grant program language. That's important. So it's important that all of those areas are streamlined and work close together. And so we're working on frequent training for our program managers as well as our grant administrative staff.
Thank you.
I'm going to let Representative Himshute go next, because I think it's on this same topic, and then I have a few people in the queue as well.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Yes, Deputy or Assistant Commissioner Halloran, thank you for being here on a Saturday. My question is, in the CS, we've extended the effective date rather than effective immediately to July of 26. Does that give your department time, the time you need, to come into compliance with the 30-day expectation? I apologize, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Hinshute, Pam Howard, for the record, we very much appreciate the new effective date of July 1, 2026. We believe that would give us time to bring staff on board, to get them up to speed, to and train them. Again, we're very complex. Our agency is managing over 200 federal programs. And with those programs comes a fair amount of structure that needs to happen in the accounting system and training around that. We believe the effective date is fine for us to get folks trained and get ramped up in time to meet our obligations.
Follow up?
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. I just want to be clear. Does that delayed effective date provide you the time you need that would you still need the additional staff, or could you, with your existing staff that the legislature has funded, meet the requirements if you had a year to get fully staffed? And then I just want to also ask if you have a work from home policy. So if you have a work from home policy, do your new staff have to be in the office for a year or two before they can work from home? Or what percent of your staff are working from home? So two questions.
Okay, Representative Hinshute, through the chair, this is Pam Halloran. We I'll hit the work from home. We do have staff that work from home, but none of our staff work from home all the time. We do prefer that our staff who are in probationary status are in the office 100% of the time, and then those hybrid form of telework happens once they hit past that probationary period with an agreement between the supervisor and the employee. To address your first question in regards to whether or not we would need the new positions, if due to the long effective date, we would have to look at that. Again, we're still managing the complexity, and it's at the accounting staff that we would need to make sure that the funding is in the right place at the right time to initiate that payment.
I also just wanted to acknowledge, I forgot to, that Representative Prox joined us in the room at the beginning of our discussion on House Bill 133. Next in the queue is Vice Chair Story, and then I have myself, and then Representative McCann.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm not sure who should answer this question, but when Rep. Hemshi was commenting that it was really kind of hard to get the extent of the problem because she didn't hear from any private contractors, any feedback about the delays they've been experiencing. I was wondering where in our budget would there be hard data that we can see who we're paying the percentage of penalty to and how we know they're outstanding. Again, I'm not sure who should answer that.
That might be a good question for the bill sponsor staff. I also would like to just invite Eric DeMolin up here, because I think that's Mr. DeMolin's also another good resource on general questions on this issue. So whoever of the two of you might like to weigh in on that.
Thank you, committee and Chair Carrick. For the record, Eric DeMolin, I am the finance director for the state of Alaska. And I'm going to ask to repeat the question. I'm sorry, I was responding to a note. I apologize.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm trying to get some baseline data since we can't, contractors haven't really said how many of their payments are delayed, and there is a penalty if we go past the 30 days. So I thought maybe somewhere in our budget columns it would show the grants that are due payments and then who has fallen into the category and how much money are we paying out in penalties, and that might help us get an extent of where of the problem.
Yeah, through the chair, Vice Chair Story, thank you for the question. We can get some baseline data together. So what I would say is that in the accounting system, there's a lot of variability in terms of how payments are made across the state. And we do so because each agency, basically when they are appropriated funds, has that authority to be able to spend those funds. So when we look at the accounting system, the elements that currently exist, a lot of them are free-form fields, and a lot of them are not required. So taking that into consideration, there's a lot of different ways that agencies process just their internal processes that best fit their businesses. So what I can say is that, like, for InvoiceSave, for example, that was spoken to by Assistant Commissioner Pam Halloran. We do have that as a universal field. So we could pull, data payment and invoice date. We just want to make sure that we reference for the committee and the data that we pull some of the potential shortcomings of that data as we work through processes and build these efficiencies. So we can get some baseline data. When it comes to specifically grants, there's a couple of different ways that we could look at trying to extrapolate that information as well. Most grants managed across the state are done so through our program structure. There are chart of account elements within our accounting system itself. And so we could use those to kind of trace back to where expenditures are posting. And we could basically see those payments through basically referencing in the system. I won't bore you with those details, but we could try to get as close as we can and make sure that we outline any of the deficiencies with any starting point. And then obviously having recommendations to better the process as well as part as we kind of look at this as a holistic issue at the state.
Follow up? And then is there sort of a category about just called penalties, and we can see what we're paying out in penalties?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Story. Yes, so there's object codes, and we're looking in our accounting system that classify various expenditure types. Penalties or fines are going to be something that is classified within that system itself. Now, what I would say again is that these are all freeform fields. So whether there's 100%, you know, integrity to that specific object code, you know, would have to be looked at as well, right? So if we think about a vendor when you pay out, you know, it would require basically two different object codes or identification of costs, you know, at that point in time when you're making the payment. So if you had an invoice, let's say it was late, and this is just a hypothetical, and you were paying it out for contractual services for whatever that is, you would have to basically identify the portion that would be attributed to a fine or penalty versus just paying the entire thing as a lump sum, right? It's like the itemization you have on your cell phone. We all see that there's 50 different charges. I'm not sure what they all mean, but we all see that it's in there. And when I pay my cell phone bill, I don't go to my personal finances and categorize which ones are which necessarily, right? I pay the bill in whole and call it cell phone bill. So when we look at that, you know, just as the aggregate, I think when we're looking at that information, we just need to know those baseline deficiencies. I don't want to say, right? But those options, right? So not everything is going to be 100% perfect, but we could get a starting point to really get what the what I would consider reasonable scope is for consideration. I just want to make sure that we understand some of the deficiencies when we're looking at large data sets across the state.
Follow up? Thank you for that. And through the chair, do we have a sense of how large of a problem this is?
Yeah, through the chair, Vice Chair Story, you know, offhand, anecdotally, I couldn't say one way or the other. You know, when we look at issues when it comes to late payments, there's a variety of reasons those occur across different state agencies. You know, a lot of them has been attributed to staffing, and I know that has been said quite a bit, just as departments have been testifying. And turnover, and when it comes to, you know, as Assistant Commissioner Halloran was, you know, referring to, make sure people are up to speed on how, you know, our subsystems, et cetera, work. So there's a variety of reasons why we would see kind of late payments. I couldn't speak to how big of an issue I think it is until I ran some preliminary figures, but be happy to do so and get back to the committee.
Thank you.
I had put myself in the queue a while back. I'm not sure if it might be that Dandy Bartola with Department of Labor is a good person to answer this, because I know a lot of the private contracts that we pay out to companies are within Department of Labor or Department of Transportation. But I think there's sort of two ways to look at this problem, right? There's the model where we have assumption of we have the model that's presented in current statute for private contractors and in House Bill 133, which is sort of a stick approach. There's also a potential for an incentive-based approach to get people on track. And I just want to understand a little bit better, does our current stick approach work in the case of private contracts? Do we pay most of our private contracts on time? How frequently do we lapse the 30 days? And if I could get a sense of that. And I don't know if there's a specific department that takes on the bulk of private contracts. That's probably who I would want to ask that question of.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Carrick. And I know that you were going to go through kind of each agency. So just anecdotally, I just kind of give my two cents, you know, on that piece. So I've been on the finance side with the state of Alaska for quite some time. I actually worked at the Department of Labor as Dante Bartolo's division operations manager for about a year. And then I was the head finance officer for the Department of Health before it split to Family Community Services and Department of Health. So I've had a lot of experience with two departments that seem to be of interest. And what I can say is that the state is always working on the idea of trying to pay everybody as quickly as possible. You know, so when we look at, you know, the stick method, so to speak, I don't see it as necessarily a deterrent other than just something that would unfortunately happen when we're trying our best to get payments out the door and we have some other issue that's precluding us to do so. So whether that's staffing levels or the like. But just in my capacity throughout the state, I've never had that be a method to where I was prioritizing one thing or the other. Because the intent is to pay everybody timely across the state in all aspects. So I wouldn't say that it has incentivized us to act any differently. I think it's a byproduct of when things go poorly, but there's other, you know, underlying issues that are causing those delay in payments. And it's that would be my comments on that.
However, as a follow-up, it does make the entities whole when you have this approach as opposed to a incentive-based approach. And so I still have the question of, for our private contractors, mm-hmm. how frequently do we lapse that 30-day requirement?
Yeah, so thank you for the question, Chair Carrick. We'll have to be able to run some numbers on a high level to try to get a baseline to be able to answer that question accurately.
And is there a department that handles more private contracts than others that we could also ask that question of?
So at the Department of Administration, we do quite a bit. We manage enterprise contracts across the state. In terms of just individual contracts and number of, I would look at possibly Don Pannone with DOT to be able to speak to that, as well as, Department of Labor, I think, would be a good one as well with Dandy Bartolo.
Well, I kind of want to follow up on this and just see if Dandy Bartolo could speak to it, because Department of Labor is a little bit smaller. It's probably easier to have offhand a little bit of anecdotal data. Mr. DiPartolo, can you talk to us about Department of Labor's private contracts, private sector contracts, and how frequently the state lapses beyond that 30 days with this current language in statute?
Absolutely. Chair Carrick, this is Dan DiPartolo, the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Labor. And happy to talk a little bit about our private contracts. So if you looked at our fiscal note we submitted, and I want to note for the committee, this was prior to version T. The fiscal note I did have in hand indicated that annually we might face about $4,200 a year in interest charges. And I extrapolated that information. I looked at a point in time of where we were late on invoices to contracts. And I would say we were 95% or better on time. So we were only seeing approximately $400 in penalties we would pay a month. And obviously, as Director DeMolin indicated, we target to always be better than 30 days. And so I do not believe there's a systemic issue, that it just happens sometimes where inevitably you go through a first-in, first-out approach with your invoices, and the people who care for either entering them in the system when they first commit or processing them on the back end, something happens. Somebody is out inevitably, or multiple people are out, or something like that happens, and you get caught in some of these situations. And so for the Department of Labor, I don't see that we're solving anything except continuing to put forward our best effort, as I indicated in our fiscal note. And I honestly think the provisions in Section 1 are completely reasonable, because every contractor should expect to be paid within 30 days of submitting a valid invoice. The only concern I have, Chair Carrick, with the private contractor side, is we have entire divisions that are almost 100% federally funded. And I think this has been mentioned before in other testimony, is that if indeed we do have to pay any kind of penalty, we cannot use federal funds to do that as part of the agreement of receiving those funds. So that is what we're looking at right now on the private side.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. And final follow-up for Mr. DiPartolo, how frequently, can you contrast that with how frequently you might be behind in payment of grants contracts for the entities that are in House Bill 133?
Chair Carrick, the grant side of it's interesting. A lot of our grants go through our LESCO Workforce Investment Board in our grant section. And one of the things I indicated, you might have seen this trend in several of fiscal notes as you're reading through them, is during the reappropriation period, which for callers in line are listening for the first time, that's the immediate time where a fiscal year is ending and a new one starting from July 1st until typically somewhere around the middle of August to the end of August. And we're spending all of our grant staff spending a lot of time closing the prior year grants and then evaluating the prior year performance, because we have a lot of grantees who reapply every year for the same grant. And sometimes if they are having performance issues and they apply for grants again, we have to put them on either performance improvement plans. It can affect the grants in some of those situations. So for us, often we are not paying out grant payments in the first 30 to 45 days. I know this is an interesting situation because grantees, what they do is they submit to us a request for payments of a grant, and typically that could be monthly or quarterly. But the way this language reads, my concern was at the very front end of the calendar year, if we're getting requests for payments during this reappropriation period, that we're not able to process grants quick enough and could be paying interest. And that's why you'll notice that in my, I put it in the actual narrative, but particularly when we had that former language of paying 20% upfront, which is now gone. We had a higher potential liability on our grants, largely because of that transition period that we call the reappropriation period. But otherwise, we find that we're able to remain fairly timely throughout the year with our grant.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Representative McCabe was next in the queue.
Thanks. I'm not sure who this is for, but I'm looking through the Department of Health fiscal notes now. Couple things. I don't think I've ever seen a bill with as many fiscal notes, frankly. And I don't think I've ever seen one department come up with six fiscal notes either, which is kind of interesting. But looking at these fiscal notes, so I am seeing, I think that the Department of Health knows how far in arrears they are because they've been able to calculate how much money it's going to cost them with a 10.5% interest rate, if I'm reading things right. Look to me to be, if all these fiscal notes come to fruition, if we don't give them $909,000 for the increased PCNs and for the office, and this sounds to me like hiring a bunch of new people at $151,300 a year. If we don't give them that, then they could be as much as, have to pay as much as $1.554 million in interest payments, because Department Support Service is 73 days average overdue for payment. Healthcare Services, 42 days. Public Assistance, 88 days. Public Health, 43 days. Senior Disabilities, 59 days. Behavior Health, 57 days. And those are averages, so I kind of would like to know what the median is. What is the longest, 88 days for public assistance is a long time when you are a single mom with three or four kids, if that's what public assistance is. And so I'd like to know what the longest time is. I'm sure there's a short time, but so... And maybe that's not for right now. Maybe that's for January, because these fiscal notes concern me greatly. The Department of Health ones do. And I think that we probably should explore these a little bit more, because this is not satisfactory. If we need to give them more people to do the job, or at least to get on top of it, maybe there's a way to hire a temp or something, especially for the Department of Health. I don't know that's a question, Ms. Halloran, but it's certainly a concern.
I would just follow up. I think to Eric DeMolin's comments earlier as well, I think this committee really needs to know what the correlation is between, and I'm saying correlation intentionally, it's not necessarily why it's occurring, but I think we need to know the correlation between vacancy rate and timely processing of payment in these different divisions. We also need to know the correlation between length of time staff have been in their positions and the late payment. Those are two things. And then I know Representative Holland had some earlier factors as well. I want to go to Representative Himshute, then Representative Holland.
I just, through the chair, wanted to offer the committee that we plan to work on this in the interim. So whatever the questions are, the departments have been responsive, and they want to solve the problem too. So we're happy to take the questions and work through interim to come back with additional information and maybe some kind of a report, if that's helpful.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, I want to come back to Director Mullen, who I know from the budget subcommittee process had shared some of the process improvement projects that were being done in different areas. Might not be exactly the grant payments, but I think there's some work, and this is kind of a question, kind of an opportunity to maybe look into this from the standpoint of rather than doubling down on finding a bunch more people to Band-Aid a process that's not working very well. I wonder if there's a different approach that's perhaps being done in some areas that might be illustrative of how we might think about this problem, and perhaps a different set of resources that maybe get provided through the budgeting process that are more directed towards providing process improvement, efficiencies, technologies. I think there was some discussion about some new information technology tools that might be put into some of these chronically unfilled positions. So I just wonder if you've got maybe a project that might illustrate how we might think differently about this as opposed to just resolving the fiscal notes in terms of, you know, are we going to have to hire a bunch of people to Band-Aid the process, or is there a different way we should be looking and supporting the departments with the resources, the tools to be able to actually improve the situation and get to maybe even a better outcome at the end where folks are getting paid and we've made life easier for the staff that are there. So it's kind of an open-ended invitation if you've got a project or way to might illustrate what you've been doing and maybe how we might think about what we should be doing.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Holland, thank you for the question. And yes, it is kind of open-ended. So I do think that there is opportunity to be able to leverage some technologies. Assistant Commissioner Halloran mentioned a couple of things. One, you know, Periscope, and then also looking at another GMS or, excuse me, grant management system within that structure and also collaborating with other departments. When we look at, you know, the processes of approvals or making sure we have payment eligibilities, there is a degree of a lot of manual work that goes into that current process today that we can build some streamlined processes with when we're looking at leveraging the systems. So, for example, you know, within the grant management system, if it's robust enough for the grant managers themselves that work for the state to be able to go through, authorize, and validate that the work's been done and process these reimbursements, and having the system talk directly to the accounting system to process payment as opposed to doing physical data entry and routing. That would be one, right? It would get rid of some of the workflows that exist currently in separation of duties between multiple staff in order to make payments go through. So when we're looking at trying to build these efficiencies across the state, you know, it was mentioned a couple of times that various agencies have different GMS systems. And that's happened over time, right? So each one of our agencies is a cognate agency for one of our federal partners. So FEMA grants go to DMVA, health grants from federal DHSS obviously go to Department of Health, so on and so forth, right? Federal Department of Transportation goes to DOT. So they're responsible for the management and receiving of these federal funds. And a lot of these grant programs were procured based off of those needs and having to manage them within these specific departments, as opposed to kind of a statewide procurement. We've gained federal funds for many years, right? So these are processes that just naturally have existed for quite some time. I think we could look at building potential synergies and, you know, like technologies. What I do know is that some GMS systems are more tailored to some types of grants versus others, right? So just kind of speaking anecdotally from conversations years ago, and I don't know if it holds true, but when I was looking at working with Dandy Bartolo, when I think we both came on board, they were looking at replacing their grant management system. And talking to some other agencies, I talked to Stephanie, who worked at Department of Education at the time, asking what they use, and they used something that was actually specific to, you know, education-type grants. Don't know what that means necessarily. I've never worked with education grants or how they may be different or why that system would be more custom tailored. But I think it's a worthwhile effort to try to build some of these synergies across the state so we could look at leveraging some of these efficiencies where we're not trying to build those efficiencies to one system of record, which is our accounting system, across 15 different other GMS systems. It creates a lot of work on central admin or my staff that manage the accounting system to accommodate interfaces from many different systems. And so when we're looking at trying to build efficiencies across the state, I don't think that's lost on me or any of my colleagues that are online right now. But it's something that is also something that creates resource constraints as well, right? I don't have enough programmers to be able to program APIs or these plugins, right, in order to do that statewide today. So when we look at different ways to address issues, I think it is an evolving kind of process, and it's something that I know that me and my colleagues would be more than happy to collaborate with and be able to try to solution it. As Director DiBartolo mentioned, like we are all working as best we can to try to remain compliant within 30 days and pay everybody as quickly as possible. And I think working together, we could build some efficiencies and try to leverage some of these technologies that I know exist.
Thank you. We will have to start to wrap up discussion on this bill today, and so I have a couple people in the queue. I'm just going to ask, since everyone's had a chance to ask some questions today, to try to keep remaining questions fairly short. Representative Vance and then McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to highlight and appreciate the sponsor of this bill, you know, doing the work. You know, when you first look at the bill, you think, oh, this is just a simple compliance bill. But this is a question that most of us have been asking, and the departments have been asking of themselves for quite some time. And I just want to mention that the audits that are done by Legislative Budget and Audit Committee are a great resource to look at the recommendations and the conversations that the departments have had with the auditor without having to rehash those questions. There's already a lot of answers there, and I think we can utilize those tools, and also the experience that, you know, was just mentioned. You know, Department of Administration has made strides just this year that we've been waiting to see for quite some time, and I really appreciate that. There's been a lot of hardship, and you know, just the experience that I've had with turnover of staff. I hire great people; they come to work in the position, and then with my office, they want to go get married and live a happy life someplace else. And so I have to bring someone new that isn't familiar with how the legislature works. And the learning curve is steep. And ever since COVID, every department is facing that. And so the question that I have is, and I apologize, I forget your name.
The chair, Representative Vance, Eric DeMolin, Director of Finance.
Director, thank you. And I don't want to put you on the spot about contracts and things like that, but the question that I have is, you know, instead of just asking for more staff, in your experience, where you've been able to raise salaries for certain positions to where you get someone that brings more experience to the table, do you find that has provided value in being able to make the timeliness and the efficiencies just because you have someone, you can more readily hire someone with experience versus bringing someone in? Or by contrast, are the jobs that we're asking unique enough that it doesn't matter who you bring in, there's a learning curve because of the specific situation of request of tasks being requested?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Vance, I would say that there's a degree of both at play into there, right? So organizations have proprietary systems. That's not new to any organization. If you get somebody with experience, there's always going to be, you know, a learning curve. More experienced people could, you can make the argument that, you know, they could pick it up quicker. And when we look at kind of raising salaries, it depends, I guess would be, you know, my personal view of it. You know, when we look at raising salaries, I'm always cognizant of, you know, trying to make sure that we're not overpaying at the same time while still paying fair, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a balancing act. you know, so to speak. And I think there's degrees on both sides that kind of go into count there. And, you know, for example, you know, mentioning, you know, the different systems that exist across the state, that's going to be an additional cost, right? So if we had one single system across, there are many agencies that have had, you know, a granting system that is very familiar to their staff. And if we looked at trying to build one kind of statewide, then we have this learning curve all over again for some of our more tenured staff that exists. You know, so there's not going to be a perfect answer one way or the other. I think that there's going to be a, you know, the, like I said, it's not going to, there's considerations on both sides, I guess I would say. So that would be my thought there. But I think, you know, fair salaries for fair work is always going to be able to drive, you know, talent. And so I know that's something that's been discussed at length with the legislature this year. So
through the chair, thank you, Director. And the reason I ask that is just because, you know, there's always a new hire, and more people typically cost more money than just paying experienced people a little bit more, because someone who has experience and knowledge in an area can do the work of three people, right? Yep. And if you pay them well, they're just efficient in their job, and are well deserving of that. And sometimes just more bodies cost more money and may not be the answer. And so finding that balance, I think, is probably the key. And it seems like the Department of Administration has made some changes that I think proved fruitful. And I would encourage, you know, the lessons learned by the department, share with the others right now who may be struggling, because I know they're seeking to fill positions, and that's been a challenge. But we want to help you find, in all of the departments, that sweet spot to be able to provide the services. So I really appreciate just offering the insight to the experience that you've brought to the table and answering a variety of questions for us today.
So we do have to kind of wrap up the discussion, Representative McCabe, and then I think we're going to move on.
So in the interest of brevity, I will cede all my time to Representative Vance.
Any further comments?
Took it all up, so now I know you need to move on. It's okay. I can wait.
Vice Chair Story.
Thank you, and I just wanted to thank everybody online for how hard they're working and for being here on Saturday. And I know Director DiBartolo has been serving for a long time. I don't know how many years, but I appreciate all of you and the experience that you bring. It's appreciated.
Yeah, I fully concur. Thank you so much to all of the folks online from different departments today. Really seriously appreciate you all being here in the room or online on a Saturday. And we'll make sure to get questions to the bill sponsor's office or directly to departments if committee members would prefer. I would just really encourage committee members to really work with our department folks who have shown a real willingness to answer questions, and with the bill sponsor over the interim, so that we can truly hit the ground running in January. And if we need to make changes to the legislation to accomplish the goal, that we do that as quickly as possible and keep it moving forward. So at this time, we're going to set House Bill 133 aside for session. And thank you to Representative Himshute and your staff for your work on this and continued work over the interim. And at this time, we're going to move to our final bill for the session.
Stapasaurus.
And it's been highly anticipated, this last one, House Bill 82, on designating a state dinosaur, from Representative Stapp, who I believe is actually upstairs in finance. So I am going to welcome to the hot seat, formerly intern, now staff, Henry Thompson. Welcome. Thank you very much for being in House State Affairs. And I just want to note for the committee, we're going to take public testimony on this bill. There's very little public testimony online today, but I want to make sure we have time for that. So, Mr. Thompson, if you want to introduce the bill for us, and then we'll go to testimony.
Thank you to the chair. For the record, this is Henry Thompson, staff to Representative Stapp. So what the bill does, of course, as I'm sure you all have gleamed, is it establishes the Nanosaurus as Alaska's state dinosaur. Now I'll tell you a little bit about the Nanosaurus. It was brought to the attention of the scientific community in 2014. It originated in it was discovered in the Prince Creek formation of the North Slope below, and since then there's been some debate, but it reigns as quite a fascinating dinosaur. It's a theropod, similar to the Tyrannosaurus rex, and it's actually part of the Tyrannosaur family. So it's got the three fingers. It's quite large, I believe the estimations are. There's some debate as to the whether it has feathers or not. Of course, this is sort of standard. I think hopefully that's a satisfactory information. We do, I believe, have a Dr. Juckenmiller on the line. He's the director of the University of Alaska Museum of the North and a very accomplished paleontologist and taxonomist. I believe some of the papers regarding this he's actually...
We're going to go to... Professor Druckenmiller is invited testimony, so we'll go to him next, and then we'll open it up to any questions. First, I just want to thank Professor Druckenmiller, who was my professor when I took Life in the Age of Dinosaurs at UAF. It was maybe the best class I ever took in college, and I am not just saying that. It was seriously like the best class ever. So I'm so glad to see you on here, Pat, and please feel free to offer your invited testimony.
Thank you. I'm very, just like to say, I'm very pleased to have this opportunity. I appreciate representative staff and Henry's interest in recognizing the great research we do at UAF and the fossils and amazing other things we have at the UA Museum of the North in Fairbanks. I'll round out a little bit of what Henry mentioned, a little bit more information about this animal very briefly, but yes, it's a Nanosaurus is Alaska's one and only Tyrannosaurus, so it belongs to this larger group of dinosaurs called Tyrannosaurids, and the most famous, of course, is Tyrannosaurus rex. We do not have Tyrannosaurus rex in Alaska that we know of, but from the North Slope, from the Prince Creek Formation, we have this relatively new species. It was named in 2014, and it is one of probably about 13 or 14 different types of dinosaurs that we know of from that formation about 73 million years ago when Alaska was farther north than it is today. So the dinosaurs, like Nanosaurus, are among the northernmost dinosaurs that ever lived on Earth. And Nanosaurus is one of four named dinosaurs from the state. We have more species. We know we have more species than that, and we'll be naming more in the future. But currently only four have names. And Nanosaurus was really, it was the top dog of its time. It was the apex predator of its environment, and it would have eaten things like duck-billed dinosaurs and horned dinosaurs. So, it's a fascinating animal. And when it was originally described, it was believed to be actually kind of a dwarf. And we wondered about that. In fact, when it was described, it was really described on the basis of really only three bones. Since then, our museum has collected quite a bit more material, and we've been able to add to the story. Our group did not name it originally, but I recently had a student, a graduate student who finished research on Nanosaurus and found that actually it's a pretty big tyrannosaur, not a small one at all, somewhere in the order of 25 to 30 feet long, and... there's a question there about feathers. You know, very likely these dinosaurs were also feathered, and that's kind of a new image maybe for a tyrannosaur you don't have. But I'll just leave it at that and open it up for if anyone has questions about this animal or about anything else I can offer.
Let's actually. Open public testimony and then come back to questions, if that's okay with the committee members. So thank you, Dr. Druckenmiller. At this time, we're going to open public testimony on House Bill 82. And I see no one in the room to offer public testimony. Okay. We'll go online, and I see just one person, Mike Coons.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Mike Coons from Wasilla, and I'm speaking for myself. After a long, grueling week, I hope this brings some levity and tongue-in-cheek. I have a suggestion for HB 82. Since the Democratic Party is now the Socialist Party, then I submit that Alaska's Democratic Party and the National DNC are now extinct. Now I don't really want the Alaska DNC or the DNC as the state of Alaska symbol for anything. However, this Nansaurus is relative to the Triceratops rex, a fear dinosaur. I would suggest any picture of Nansaurus show a representation of the DNC being fed to Nansaurus by the good Republican men and women at the sacrifice. By the way, for those who will take offense to this testimony, the reason the DNC is dead and dying is they have no sense of humor. I support HB 82, please, children of our state. Thank you.
As always, Mr. Coons, we appreciate you calling in and being engaged in the public process. Thank you so much for testifying today. I am laughing, by the way, and I am a Democrat, so just adding that for the record. Sir, committee question on House Bill 82. I think I saw Representative Vance earlier and then Representative Himshute.
So my question, the bill sponsor is, are there any drawings or renditions? I'm highly disappointed in the bill packet that I don't have a caricature or something that I can understand the visual of what this dinosaur could potentially look like.
For the record, Bernard Otto, staff to Representative Stapp, through the chair to Representative Vance, the sponsor does have a toy Nanosaurus located in our office, which is free for any member to come and see if they would like. And there is also a drawing in our office as well.
Thank you.
I actually forgot to close public testimony on House Bill 82, so at this time I'm going to close public testimony. Sorry about that. Is there any other discussion from committee members? Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Googling Nanosaurus image as we speak. Through the chair, oh, yeah, that's a T-Rex for sure. My question is for Dr. Druckenmiller. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Druckenmiller, you gave a pretty good case for why Nanosaurus would be a good candidate for a state dinosaur. I was looking for, is there an older or a more frequent or a more geographically diverse dinosaur? And so I was hoping you might weigh in. I found we had ichthyosaurs up on the North Slope. Maybe there's an ichthyosaur that could be a good candidate. And then here in Southeast Alaska, where I'm from, in Cake, they found the thalattosaur. And so, and I know that duck-billed dinosaurs were all over, hadrosaurs. So I am a novice at this, but rather than just gravitate to our one and only tyrannosaur, is there any other dinosaur that could be more representative of the state? And I will follow my question with the comment that I would like the children of the state to choose the state dinosaur, which is common in other states that children choose the state insect or the state whatever. So that was my question for Dr. Druckenmiller.
Thank you for that question. Yes, great question. Actually, there are a number of other extinct reptiles that we know of from Alaska. Just to comment on a few of those, we did describe in a paper, oh gosh, 15 years ago, an ichthyosaur, which is a marine reptile that kind of looked like a giant dolphin, that we know from various places in the state, actually. So we described a specimen from up on the North Slope in the Brooks Range. Now, the trick with ichthyosaurs is, in spite of that sore ending, it's it's actually not a dinosaur. It belongs to a different group of reptiles. And so it wouldn't... I think it would be wonderful to have a state ichthyosaur because I'm very partial to those, but it's not technically a dinosaur. Down in Southeast, the thalatosaur that you refer to was a specimen that we collected and named at the Museum of the North, Gnathidae josiae, and that is also a marine reptile in a different group and, alas, also not a dinosaur. but again, a wonderful candidate is just an amazing, amazing skeleton. On the dinosaur side, you mentioned hadrosaurs. So for those of you not familiar, a hadrosaur is also known as a duck-billed dinosaur. These are large plant-eating animals. Some of them, the best one that we know of is a species that we named from the North Slope. In fact, was almost certainly eaten by Nanoxaurus. And its name is Agrinolix cucpigensis, which is derived from the Inupiaq words that means ancient shore of the Colville River. It is a species we know quite a bit about. We have a lot of material of it. And I will say to your comment about kids being involved, which I think, you know, that's great. The idea for a state dinosaur, I know that this bill is not the first to have come forward on that. And one of the original proposals actually was for this duck-billed dinosaur as a state dinosaur. Because there's only four named types of dinosaurs right now in Alaska, again, there will be more. We're working on that. I would say those four dinosaurs are known to different degrees, to different extents. Like, we have more of some of those animals than we have of others, so we just know more about them. But all four of those, I suppose, could also be considered and put forward as a possible state dinosaur, if that was something that, was decided by the legislature. So there are really only those four to choose from, though, at the moment.
Thank you.
Representative Holland?
Great, thanks. I just was flipping through the section of all the state things that we have. It's an interesting collection. But I'd like to just follow up with the doctor from, UAF on this. I'm just curious, it reminded me of the time when this Nanoxaurus would have been making tracks. And how would you describe the place of this dinosaur was living? I mean, we think of Alaska as it exists at the moment, and we try and put it into context of fossils found on the North Slope, but that's probably not the place that this creature actually lived. How would you describe the place on the planet where this ground was actually at, and the nature of the climate, and what was this place that these dinosaur bones that we found in what is today Alaska, what was that place at the time that this dinosaur actually was roaming the earth?
Thank you for that question, I'm glad someone asked that. That's great. The dinosaur, so Nanoxaurus lived during the Cretaceous period, in fact near the end, not too long before the very end of the Age of Dinosaurs, at which it was at 66 million years ago. And so Nanoxaurus, the best we know, was alive about 73 million years ago. And what's really interesting is I kind of briefly mentioned the state of Alaska, what there was of it, it didn't look quite like it did today for sure, was farther north than it is today. And in fact, our best estimates of that part of the North Slope, it was actually probably about 10 degrees of latitude farther north than today, meaning it was truly, the dinosaurs that lived in northern Alaska at that time were truly polar dinosaurs. And there were no other dinosaurs we know of on Earth that lived as far north as that any time through the Age of Dinosaurs. And that, what's fascinating about that is those dinosaurs lived on sort of a low, flat coastal plain, the Brooks Range was actually very much around and even forming at that time. But those dinosaurs, where we find them, would have been north of the Brooks Range, just like today, on a flat coastal plain, but it was forested. So even that far north, we know that that area was completely forested, and it was not a tundra setting at all like it is today, which is kind of crazy to imagine, but we actually find petrified trees right up there with the dinosaurs. And in terms of climate, the reason that was possible was globally the climate was much warmer than today, and even though it was farther north, the climatic environment there was actually very much, in terms of its yearly temperature, very similar to what it is today in Juneau. So about an average annual temperature of around somewhere in the low 40 degree Fahrenheit range. So relatively warm, relatively wet, really far north. And the last thing I'd add about it is, because it was so far north, the dinosaurs that we know actually had to have lived there year-round, that's another story, were subject to 3 to 4 months of complete winter darkness. So Nanuxaurus would have been roaming around during the winter months in these forests, probably in even at times in snowy conditions. So pretty crazy image compared to our usual view of what we think of dinosaurs as being kind of tropical. So I hope that kind of paints the picture a little bit.
That was fascinating. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, Professor Druckenmiller, this is why it was one of my favorite classes. You can imagine. Has the best explanations for things.
Well, if I can just follow up on the question that Representative Himshu was asking, it was, are these still cold blooded? How did the darn things stay warm?
Great question. There's been a long debate about dinosaurs and whether they were warm-blooded like mammals and birds, or whether they were cold-blooded like modern reptiles, because dinosaurs were very much reptiles. The best of our knowledge is that we understand most dinosaurs as having been much closer to a warm-blooded bird or mammal today. And in fact, one of the best pieces of evidence for the dinosaurs being warm-blooded that we have is the fact that they lived so far north in places like Alaska during the Age of Dinosaurs, because it was cold in the winter. I mean, it was snowy at times. There were freezing conditions. And just like today, we know we don't have we don't have crocodiles, and we don't have turtles, and we don't have lizards in Alaska. It's simply too cold today, and it was simply too cold for those animals back in the Age of Dinosaurs, which are very common as fossils at much lower latitudes in places like Montana and Alberta. So we are pretty darn certain that these dinosaurs in Alaska were more or less warm-blooded. They maintained, elevated body temperatures, and they generated their own heat from the food they ate, just like we do as mammals. Oh, and last comment there, the feathers, the meat-eating dinosaurs we know of from up there were almost certainly feathered, and that is something you only see in warm-blooded animals, because warm-blooded animals want to keep the warmth in. If you're cold-blooded, you don't want to have insulation on the outside that keeps the external heat from the sun getting to you. So, again, really good evidence they were warm-blooded.
Now we know why we have feathers. It's not for flight.
They were wearing down parkas, yes.
We are going to go to Mr. Ayoto, because I can see he has a response, and then we're going to start to wrap up discussion on this bill after that. So.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. For the record, Bernard Ayoto, staff to Representative Stapp. And I'd like to extend an apology from Representative Stapp. He would love to be here to have this discussion. Unfortunately, he's still in House Finance. He wanted to send me down here so that I could speak a little bit to the purpose of the bill, kind of in relation to Representative Himshute's query about the different types of dinosaurs and children picking the dinosaur. While he was touring the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, he went to some elementary school classes and was speaking about the legislature and the importance of the legislature and the things that legislators do down here. And when he was trying to get the students to engage in a similar sort of debate, he asked them what sort of things they like to argue about. And it started a debate about dinosaurs. And so when coming down to Juneau for this legislative session and thinking about the type of legislation to introduce, that was something that came up and kind of is the purpose of the bill in total.
So I'm going to go to Vice Chair Story and then Representative Himshue.
Through the chair, thank you for that history a little bit about why Rep. Stapp was interested in this. And I just wanted to lend my support to helping children look at the choices again. I appreciate the explanation that we have, but I do think it would be a wonderful educational opportunity. And so I don't know, my question to the sponsor would be, would they be open to maybe through the Department of Education sending out a survey and a little blurb about the different dinosaurs that we had, because you have put together some education on it. And I think that that would be a fascinating time to educate them and then hear what they decided.
Through the record to Representative Story, that's certainly something that we are open to.
Thank you.
Representative Himshue?
Through the chair, I just want to go a little higher on Bloom's taxonomy there with my colleague from the Education Committee to more of a synthesis and argument level on the taxonomy, where the students could, rather than a survey, through the chair, the students could actually make an argument, make a reasoned argument for which dinosaur should be Alaska's dinosaur. And that's a lot of work on whatever office might run that, or the department or whatever, but it's a fabulous opportunity for students to both learn about the dinosaurs and then use synthesis and argumentation to make a case for which dinosaur. So it would just be a higher level opportunity for our kids.
Vice Chair Story?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. And then they could vote on the one that they would like. It'd be a very good exercise in civic engagement.
Mail-in ballots.
Well, lest we stray off into an elections debate at the very last moments of state affairs, no signature required. We will be setting House Bill 82 aside. Thank you to the bill sponsor's staff for being here. Really appreciate it. I know Rep. Stapp is otherwise engaged, but I really appreciate that we were able to get this on the calendar, and want to really thank Professor Druckenmiller for waiting for so long to testify and then providing so much great insight into paleontology in Alaska and specifically the Nanocosaurus. So that does conclude the business of House State Affairs for this session. I just had a couple closing comments. I wanted to sincerely thank this committee for consistently showing up, engaging in good debate. There were a few things we covered throughout the session that I think were hard topics. We talked about late payment of contracts. We talked about late receipt of benefits. We talked about long-term fiscal planning. We talked about elections. We talked about a lot of really challenging subjects. And lest I get choked up, I'm just really grateful to the committee for working with our office so closely all session. And I also just want to thank the staff who have staffed our committee. So Andy Magnuson has been here pretty much the entire committee. Today we've been joined by Marnie, but we have had several different Juneau LIO folks throughout session, and I'm really grateful to all of them. And because I think often we forget about the people behind the scenes, I want to thank the staff in our offices. And I just want to read their names really quickly. In Representative McCabe's office, we have Julie Morris and Angie Steffel. Thank you to both of them. In Representative Vance's office, we have Bob Ballinger, who has been a great resource for the committee. So thank you to him. In Representative Moore's office, we have longtime staffer Josh Appleby, and we have Rose Larson. Thank them for being great partners with us. In Representative Himshute's office, we have Thatcher Brower, Claire Fordyce, and Ella Lubin. I'm extremely grateful to all of them for being available. Representative Story's office, we have Sherry Bowman, who I'm very partial to, Honor Miller Austin, and Tammy Smith. I want to thank all of them. In Rep. Holland's office, we have Cameron Ebersold and Shayna Kilcoyne, as well as Corbin Morrison. Thank you to all of them. And this is why I'm getting choked up. Last but not least, I would not be able to work in this building or do anything that I have been able to do all session without all of my staff. I had an incredible intern this session who is not here anymore, but Cadence Connor graduated from UAF last week, so I'm really grateful to her. To Griffin Sakeo, who's not here today but has staffed the Transportation Committee admirably. To Jake in my office, who has also been such an incredible resource. And this committee would truly not be possible without Stuart Relay, who has put in hours every weekend since session began, at least 6 hours a weekend for this committee specifically, and has often worked till about 8 p.m., 9 p.m. at night to make this committee possible, and who is just all around essential, I think, to all of us in this building who are trying to do good work. And he put a note in here to thank the staff in the room, but if I didn't thank Stuart for the work that he's done, I would be deeply remiss. But as I thought about doing that, I just recalled all the staff in all of our offices and really want to acknowledge them publicly on the record and thank them sincerely for being available. And thank you to Ledge Legal. I know we've said that before, but thank you to Ledge Legal. So with that said, there's no further business this year to come before State Affairs. I'll let folks have closing comments. Representative McCabe.
So thanks, Chair Carrick. And from my office, we have nominated Stuart as the hardest working staffer in the building, just so you know. So he gets the award from the McCabe office for that position.
Representative Himshute.
I was just going to offer maybe he should be rewarded with some gold and silver specie.
That might not be legal, but I'd be happy to buy donuts.
Well, I do know that Stuart takes a payment in beverages at the Triangle, too. So if anybody would like to come and join us anytime.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Vance.
I just wanted to say thank you to you as a chairman. I think a lot of people have perceptions about partisanship in this building. And when we're on the floor, we debate and we disagree on legislation. But a chairman can set the mood in a committee that creates open dialogue, and you have done that. And I just want to appreciate that you have treated the minority as equals. And that is such a testimony to you as a chairman. So thank you.
All right. We better shut up so I don't cry.
Too late.
Too late. I started reading their names, and I've known most of these staff for a really long time, and my name never got read into the record for thanks as a staffer, so I'd like to pay it forward. A lot of these folks whose names we read today have worked in this building longer than any of us have, and our office has had a real joy working with all of your offices, truly. With no further business to come before State Affairs, we will not be meeting over the interim, but I am available if folks would like to have discussions over the interim, and we would certainly like to continue some discussions around fiscal policy next session and around other topics that come before this committee. And with no further business before us in this 2025 session, we are adjourned at 5:37 p.m.